Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Nina Teicholz. Nina is the author of The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. That's a provocative claim, but she backs it up with facts. She's the author of an article that caused a flap in the British Medical Journal, attracted a lot of backlash, but the facts are with her. And Nina, also what's come to light since I last talked to you is the degree to which the sugar industry has enlisted scientists and nutritionists to parrot the party line that sugar isn't bad for you. And there's been a big cover-up. It's kind of like the whistleblower, the movie with about the tobacco industry.
Right. Yeah, with the CBS BlackRock investigative unit finding out about the tobacco industry. And so nothing is ever as straightforward as it looks. And this is another story like that. But it's interesting. So what's happened is that there are a number of professors, particularly at UCSF, and then activist groups that are really focusing on sugar. And what they've done is they've dug up a lot of documents about how the sugar industry has manipulated the science. So to give you just a couple of examples, one is the sugar industry managed to kind of bury the science that sugar causes cavities, right? Which is amazing, right? I mean, we all kind of know that sugar causes cavities, but they were able to sort of to bury that and replace it with all kinds of other, like if you just brush and floss and then you have, we'll fill your cavities as you have them. There are all these other kinds of procedures that, of course, support keeping dentists in business, and rather than just telling everybody to stop eating sugar. So, and that was something that the sugar industry did. They also funded, this is a report that came out in JAMA Internal Medicine that got a lot of publicity about how the sugar industry funded a review of sugar by two Harvard scientists who ended up saying they didn't think sugar was really that bad for health.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just got
$5,000 a piece or something like that. But that was in 1965, so that was actually pretty decent
that
money.
That was a significant amount of
money.
You
could buy a Pontiac in 1965 for $5,000, I think.
Yeah. So kind of there's two catches here. One is that, the people that they funded at Harvard, who included Mark Hegstead, he had been for years already publishing on the idea that fat, saturated fat, cholesterol cause heart disease. So he truly believed in that hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hazard to say that when he took that money from the sugar industry, he was already convinced that mm-hmm. fat was the culprit. Mm-hmm. So he was just, accepting money to do something that was consistent with, coincided with mm-hmm. his already existing beliefs. And I don't believe that that money really swayed him. And it's true that industry money sometimes is corrupting, but sometimes it isn't.
Yeah.
Sometimes people just accept, like, for instance, if right now, I mean, I wouldn't do this, but like, what if the beef industry came to me and said, why don't you write a paper on how you think red meat is good for health? And I would think, oh, that's just consistent with what I might believe to be true. But of course you should never do that.
Yeah.
Because you're,
it undermines your credibility.
Propriety.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, but I think in this case that the Harvard scientists really, they had an established track record of already believing that fat was bad. So, which is to say, the sugar industry did corrupt and undermine science whenever they could, but not that everything they did was successful.
Mm-hmm.
It is true, and I think this is interesting, that the very first dietary guidelines in 1980, actually written by that Harvard professor, Mark Hegstead, did include a warning about sugar. And then subsequently, that warning disappeared and didn't come mm-hmm. back until just last year. So clearly the sugar industry was hard at work in doing whatever they were doing, and there's many things that we don't know about. But the other thing going on here is that we have this new group of activists who's very focused on sugar, and rightly so. I mean, sugar seems terrible, empty calories, produces an adverse metabolic reaction in the body. But it would be unfair, I think, to say that it's just the sugar industry that is manipulating all of food science. You know, in my own research, I found an incredibly active body of industry actors in the vegetable oil industry who were manipulating the science to make vegetable oils look healthier than they were, and to demonize saturated fats.
And in fact, if you check, I periodically check, and I wonder if they're going to change this. But if you still go to the American Heart Association site, they still say replace butter with vegetable oil, and make sure that you have low-fat dairy. I mean, they continue to parrot that. I mean, there's so much evidence suggesting that refined oils that are rich in omega-6 fats contribute to a lot of problems. They, you know, oxidative effects in the body, you know, the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 gets altered unfavorably. That's very problematic.
Absolutely. Right. But the vegetable oil industry that they were one of the most active manipulators and influencers of the science behind all of our official guidelines for generations. So all I'm saying is, yes, maybe sugar is like tobacco, but there are many tobaccos. Yeah. I mean, the grain industry, you have to see, you know, one of the biggest beneficiaries of the shift in our dietary patterns has been the vast increase in the amount of grains that we eat. Basically, most of our manufactured foods, most of what's in supermarket shelves are made up of some form of grains and vegetable oil. Mm-hmm. You know, those industries and some sugar. So all those industries benefited. And to single out sugar is to ignore this larger history. They should all be equally singled out and understood so that we have an accurate understanding of what's gone on in the history of our nutrition science.
Yeah, another shift that has occurred. Another shift that's occurred is that CSPI, the Center for Science and Public Interest, which has been an avowed foe of yours on your critique of the guidelines, because they're all for low fat diets, and actually they were the ones who first blew the whistle on what are called tropical oils, the use of palm oil and coconut oil in foods, which was supplanted with, unfortunately, trans fats because those oils are saturated. Is it your conclusion? You know, we talked about meat earlier and saturated fat from meat. Is it your conclusion that there's little evidence to indict these plant sources of saturated fats? Because coconut oil is all the rage these days. It's making a big comeback.
Yeah, there's no evidence to indict any form of saturated fat. And this is from large randomized controlled clinical trials in fairly well controlled settings, multi-center, government funded on more than 50,000 people. There's huge amount of clinical trial data on this that collectively demonstrates that there's no type of saturated fat that can be found and they didn't separate out different kinds of saturated fatty acids. But no saturated fat showed any negative effect on your cardiovascular health. So, you know, CSBI, they've been one of the strongest foes of saturated fats, and they're one of the greatest defenders of the guidelines now. You know, they've just grown up with that status quo since the 1970s. They've been on board with that conventional advice. Now the science behind that conventional advice is crumbling, and they are scrambling to defend it using whatever tactics it appears they can possibly use. So they're one of those bullying tactics I mentioned. They use those right and left, and they were behind the whole retraction letter, and they were behind kicking me off that or getting me disinvited from the food policy panel. I mean, they are working very hard to kind of protect and shore up their the dietary guidelines. They're very close to the government on this. I don't think they started out that way in the early 1970s, but they have been dominant players in Washington for so many decades. They've really just grown cozy with the government.
It sounds like politics. You can have your facts and you can have alternative facts. <You know? laughs> Right? It's like, whose facts?
Right.
you know.
Well, I mean, I think now it's interesting. Now really is an interesting moment. I mean, it's a scary moment for many people in politics, but you know, you can point to the dietary guidelines as a captured government policy that, you know, that really does seem to have gone terribly wrong. It certainly hasn't made any progress on fighting the chronic diseases of obesity and diabetes, and they may have very well have caused them. And now they seem to be unable to admit their mistake or any kind of wrongdoing or shift course in any way. And, you know, it's a terrible state of affairs. So it really does play into the hands of, you know, people who are libertarians who feel like, you know, the government should just
butt out of dietary recommendation. Out of the business of making dietary recommendations, because they've done such a dismal job of it, is let the marketplace of ideas prevail. And, you know, certainly you and figures like Gary Taubes have been very successful in the marketplace of ideas, influencing many publications to get the word out about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm biased, of course, but I think that our interpretation of the science better explains the observations. That's the point of science. Mm-hmm. You try to explain the observations. So you explain, here's the observation. Since 1980, we've had an obesity and diabetes epidemic that coincides with Americans increasing carbohydrates by 30%. and since 1965, our consumption of fat has dropped by 25%, and saturated fat is down. So we followed the guidelines and we got fatter and sicker. So to say that America, you know, the kind of the conventional wisdom is Americans are just not doing a good enough job of following the guidelines. Mm-hmm. That seems to not, but that's not explained. That's not the facts here.
Yep.
So again and again, the facts are kind of on the side of our explanation, which is that, you know, a diet excessively high in carbohydrates, especially grains, refined grains and sugars provokes obesity and diabetes, and that's what we've got. That's what we currently have recommended to Americans. If you're a diabetic, that is what is recommended to you. So that's why the kind of ideas that Gary Taubes and I are putting forward, they just simply make sense, and they're supported by this, you know, by the evidence.
How about this devil's advocate argument, which is that by legitimizing or vindicating saturated fats, I mean, typically, you know, it's all great in theory, but things get lost in the execution. And Americans may get the signal that it's okay to take in tons of fat, saturated fat, any kind of fat. That's what's being messaged these days. And then they add to it, you know, a hot fudge sundae dessert or a cannoli have pancakes for breakfast with their sausage and bacon. And things will get even worse because that'll just hike our overall caloric intake. Does that concern you at all?
You know, I think there's a little evidence to show that eating saturated fat in the context of a high-carb diet has some kind of inflammatory effect that is negative. There is some evidence pointing in that direction. But here's your option now. Do you cut out saturated fats, which means you cut out dairy and meat and foods that are nutritionally dense and that are healthy for you
and produce satiety,
right? Protein and fat are what, you know, they fill you up so that you don't overeat. Do you reduce those foods so you can keep eating your high carbohydrate diet, which doesn't produce satiety and creates all kinds of health problems, or do you reduce carbs? I mean, to me, you know, all the evidence points to the solution that, given those options, you'd reduce carbs. Mm-hmm. You reduce carbohydrates because carbohydrates produce an insulin effect, because they produce fatty fructose and sugar and fruit seem to produce fatty liver disease. I mean, it's clear that it's the carbohydrates that are leading to these kind of metabolic disorders that are at the root of obesity and diabetes.
And what about this thrust that's coming from the government, which is, and this was accentuated during Michelle Obama's reign over our nutrition policies, which is that, you know, eat everything in moderation, but exercise, because you can expiate your dietary sins by exercising. I think that that was kind of a diversion from what the real problem was, is, you know, this emphasis on exercise. I'm all for exercise. Exercise is great. But in terms of combating our obesity epidemic, is exercise overrated?
Yeah. I mean, according to the government's own report that it did, looking at all the data in 2008, okay, and this is with the bias in favor of exercise, because the government has for quite a while now been recommending that you get 45 to 60 minutes of aerobic exercise every day.
Yikes.
In order to just to maintain your weight, which to me sounds completely exhausting.
Right. And then the net result is that 95% of Americans don't achieve the guideline goal. So
they don't achieve it. But what this 2008 report concluded is that that exercise was ineffective. So that, and that really, wow, what it was, it, you needed a dietary solution. And what the, and there's all sorts of, evidence to show that, you know, people that, you know, I guess the most depressing example of this is the study that is, of marathon, where they split a group and half,
yes,
of them, they trained to run marathons.
That.
The other half did nothing. The marathoners ended up being not an ounce lighter than the do-nothingers,
right,
at the end of the study.
Well, they were carbo-loading like crazy. They thought that they had what's called moral licensing. They figured, hey, I did 10 miles on the track or outside today. I can chow down on that cherry pie. And
even if that's the case, I mean, the point is exercise makes you hungry. That kind of aerobic exercise makes you hungry. And you can't, you know, unless you're a model and your career depends upon it, most people are unable or unwilling to starve themselves. So if you burn up thousands of calories in exercise, you will replace it. Your body will generate a hunger signal and you replace those calories. So that's what happens when people do aerobic exercises. Not so much when you do different kinds of, when you do like intense weightlifting, other kinds of exercises seem to be more effective at actually improving your insulin sensitivity, which makes you more able to absorb, digest carbs. But the point is, this is increasingly being understood as you cannot exercise your way out of a bad diet.
Mm-hmm.
If your diet is, if you're overeating and eating junk food, refined carbohydrates, sugar, even too many carbohydrates altogether, exercise is not going to make the marginal difference. And in fact, the experiments that they've done where they don't have people exercise, they simply change their macronutrient profile. They go very low in carbohydrates, very high in fat, keep protein moderate. That seems to be highly effective without any exercise whatsoever. So I think exercise has been overrated for weight loss, which doesn't mean that it's not effective for a lot of other things. Like I'm exercised for mental health, so that I don't scream at my family members.
Indeed. No, clearly. But I think that what's happened is the food industry has kind of used exercise as kind of a diversion. They said, well, you know, part of a healthy lifestyle, you can have yourself a Coke here and there. We now offer a Coke in smaller containers, so you'll moderate. And then if you just, you know, hit the basketball court, you know, you'll be fine. But, you know, that's a diversion. In an effort to save their profit margin on less than optimal
on Coca-Cola products.
Yeah.
Right. In fact, some of the investigative journalist work that's been done lately has been found the degree to which Coca-Cola, particularly, but I'm sure Pepsi does it too, which they fund what's called the energy balance theory of obesity, which basically says, you know, calories in, calories out. So if you exercise enough, you can eat as many calories as you want, as long as you exercise in a way. And that that idea of obesity is turns out not to be very well supported by the evidence, but it preserves kind of the legitimacy of drinking Coke or eating junk food. And so that's why those companies have funded that, including they've funded the CDC, the government. They've funded some of our public health institutions. I mean, it's very nefarious how deeply their money has reached, including they funded Hillary Clinton's campaign, some of her campaign people, and Michelle Obama. So yeah.
No, clearly, because it's a diversionary tactic. And, you know, maybe they funded the exercise machine makers who give you a little metric on after 45 minutes of exercise that you burned off 385 calories, so you're entitled to that package of Oreos. Which is not the point of exercise. Right, exactly.
Right.
All right. So we've got we've hit on a lot of topics here, and this is a great entree to your website, your book. Tell us what listeners will find if they go to thebigfatsurprise.com, your website. What do you have there?
You know, mainly it's coverage of the book, and I have to say that it's not. I have the whole history of what happened on the BMJ. I have some other interesting blog posts there, but it hasn't been too active, and that's and I'm just in the process of transitioning to a new website, which hopefully should be up in the next.
But you have a newsletter.
A while, which will be
MinaTeichels.com.
Yeah, I have a sporadic newsletter. Yes.
Okay.
You can sign up for my newsletter, and I will send you. I mean, I tend to focus on what is happening in the world of food and politics. Nutrition science is just as much about politics, as we've discussed today, as it is about the science itself. So I think that the nexus of those two subjects is incredibly important to understanding, like, why your doctor tells you what he tells you or she tells you, why, you know, trying to understand this landscape out there of nutrition advice. It's politics.
Yep. All both
even more so than science.
Oh, absolutely. It is, you know, people think that this is some pure scientific endeavor. Science is science, but science is shaped by societal attitudes and by political interests, and sometimes follow the money trail to some sort of aggrandizement of one or another industry that's supported by the science. So we got to be careful.
Correct.
We get in trouble.
Right.
So thank you so much for, you know, your ongoing work in this area and your courage in taking on a very, very powerful and entrenched establishment. Really, you showed great valor in writing that article, standing up for the science, and I think the true science, and endured a lot of backlash. Here you are, still standing, still productive, and offering us great advice. So once again, I recommend the book, The Big Fat Surprise, lays it out, and check out the website and follow Nina Teichels as she transitions to a new website. Thank you so much for joining us, Nina. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you for all those kind words, and thank you for having me on the show. It's really a pleasure to talk to you and your listeners.
I always enjoy it, and maybe we'll do a reprise when there's new information to share with our audience.
Sounds great. I think that will be true for quite a while until the dietary guidelines change.
All right. We'll have you back on. Thanks. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.